Hello, I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk coming up this week.
I think that story has rebounded on the newspaper. They were trying to use it to best effect to damage Gordon Brown. And actually, if you look even on the Sun's own website at the comments from its own readers, the majority of those are actually in sympathy.
The Sun goes to town on Gordon Brown. We discuss the rights and wrongs of the tabloid's attack on the PM. Was the rest of the media right to follow its lead? Plus, Melvyn Bragg returns to BBC Two, more jobs go at The Guardian, and...
I think people are often surprised when they meet me because they think that my persona is that I'm going to snarl and be horrible about everything and look them up and down and dismiss them. I'm just a bit more goonish than that, really, in real life.
Charlie Brooker tells us about his anger management issues, but would you pay to read him online? I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, Sesame Street celebrates its 40th birthday this week, but our panel today is anything but a bunch of Muppets. Maggie Brown is a Media Guardian columnist and the biographer of Channel 4. Lovely to see you, Maggie.
Thank you.
Are you excited by the new chairman at Horse Free Road? Finally.
Am I not exactly excited? I'll be excited by whom he chooses to run Channel
4.
Big question, though.
That will be interesting. Also here is Steve Ackerman, managing director of Something Else, the largest independent radio production company in Britain. What's causing you more joy, Steve? Is it DJ Spoonie on 606 or the all-new Gardener's Question Time?
Well, I'd have to say both, wouldn't I?
Yes, they're both your productions, of course. Going well, all of them?
They are going more than well.
Excellent. More TV and radio talk later, but we'll start the week with the press.
Gordon Brown is facing more criticism over a letter he sent to the mother of a soldier killed in Afghanistan. Details of a phone call he made to Jackie Janes have been released by the Sun newspaper. The Prime Minister insists he didn't spell her son Jamie's name wrong. She says she begs to differ. Our political correspondent Norman Smith has heard a recording of the conversation.
It's a very impassioned confrontation, I think you could call it.
Yes, it's been the main news this week, as delivered there by Five Lives' Sheila Fogarty. The Sun splashed on Monday with a picture of the Prime Minister's badly scrawled message to agree mother, but there was widespread condemnation of the paper's decision the following day when it posted the audio of that private conversation between Gordon Brown and Jackie Janes on its website. The BBC also received a fair bit of flack for following the tabloid's agenda, while News International itself is believed to have been split over the handling of the story. So, did The Sun go too far in its attack on the Prime Minister? First of all, I asked Lance Price, who is a former communications chief at the Labour Party.
There was a clear decision taken at the top of News International in Britain that they were going to abandon the Labour Party, they were going to abandon Gordon Brown, and they were going to make as much noise about that as they possibly could. So they timed their announcement during the Labour Party conference just after Gordon Brown's speech to gain maximum impact. I think it's in their commercial interest to do that. It gets them a lot of publicity. And there are suggestions that they have done some sort of informal deal with the Conservative Party, which will further their business interests. And that's the way in which News International always behaves.
Now, it's very interesting that you say that it's News International in Britain that's done that. Now, we know that News International in Britain is run by James Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks and those sorts of people. Are you suggesting that dear old Rupert wasn't entirely in 100% agreement with this?
Well, everything that we read about that suggests that Rupert Murdoch wasn't involved in the decision and may even have regretted the decision. There was a recent biography of him by a man called Michael Wolfe, and he's written that on the basis of his discussions with Rupert Murdoch, he doesn't believe that Rupert Murdoch has fallen out of love with Gordon Brown. And there have been suggestions recently on the Sky website, which Sky, of course, also owned by News Corporation, the parent company, that Rupert Murdoch isn't altogether happy with the decision, but he's decided that James Murdoch, his son, is now running the show in Britain and he has to make his own decisions.
Now, interestingly, it seems that even in London, there isn't total backing for what the new editor of The Sun has done, because we understand that Tom Newton Dunn, the former defence correspondent, now the political editor, did actually counsel a bit of caution on this particular story this week.
You can understand why some wiser heads on The Sun might be concerned about the way in which the newspaper has been conducting itself in recent days, in particular over the Jamie Janes story. I think that story has rebounded on the newspaper. They were trying to use it to best effect to damage Gordon Brown. And actually, if you look even on the Sun's own website at the comments from its own readers, the majority of those are actually in sympathy with Gordon Brown. They feel that he was, the Prime Minister was acting with dignity, was doing his best to express his genuine, heartfelt condolences and feelings about what had about the death of Jamie Janes, and that actually that the Sun's coverage was unfair, was vindictive. And I think that the paper has actually paid a price for going over the top on this.
And it's interesting as well that the government, which isn't known for getting its spin doctoring absolutely right these days, has actually managed to exploit this quite well. The Minister for the Today programme, Lord Mandelson, seems to have caught a chink here, hasn't he? And it's interesting how he's been turning it to the government's advantage carefully.
I think both Gordon Brown and Lord Mandelson, but Peter Mandelson in particular, recognised that this was a very important moment in their relationship, not just with the Sun, but with the media as a whole. And while Gordon Brown conducted himself with great dignity, even in that taped, secretly and quite honestly illegally taped conversation with Mrs. Janes, the Prime Minister conducted himself with great dignity, while he's allowed Lord Mandelson to go out there on the offensive in the media battle. And I think what Lord Mandelson has done very effectively is to remind the whole of the media that the Sun does have a campaigning role, that it's out to get Gordon Brown, if you like. Any suggestion of balance or fairness in its coverage has gone out the window in the process. That has done two things, in my view. One, it's helped prepare the public generally for more of the same from the Sun and warned the public not to take it too seriously. But it's also fired a shot over the bows of the rest of the media not to follow the Sun's agenda, not to think that stories that are running big in the Sun are necessarily something that should be carried on the BBC or elsewhere in the media.
It was quite astonishing that story was leading the BBC for 2 days. Undoubtedly it is a story, but I mean, I did wonder about the independent editorial judgments prevailing on at the BBC at that time. Do you think the success here, the partial success, you might say, in the government's response, is one of the reasons why Lord Mandelson is being touted as a sort of Minister for Information?
Well, I think Lord Mandelson already was the Minister for Information. He is far and away the most experienced and smart media operator in Gordon Brown's team. After the McBride scandal affair, the operation within Downing Street itself, the press office in Downing Street, has been emasculated. They can't function in the way that they used to be able to, and you could argue that they weren't doing a very good job of it in any case. But Peter Mandelson knows what he's doing. He understands how the media in Britain works. He understands how News International works. And he understands how to press the right buttons when it comes to the BBC. The Labour Party, the Labour government, is going to rely more than ever before on getting a fair shout on the broadcast media in the coming election, because they're almost certainly going to go into that election with the lowest level of support amongst the newspapers, certainly since 1979, if not even before that. So firing some pretty powerful shots over the bow of the BBC and the other broadcasters is very important, and Lord Mandelson understands that.
You, of course, used to be in that sort of role when you were Director of Communications at the Labour Party. What would be your advice now for Labour as it faces a hostile media in the run-up to the next general election?
I think at this stage in the campaign, the important thing is to isolate as effectively as they can both the Sun and the Daily Mail, who are the two newspapers which are going to try to do the most damage to Labour as the election approaches. Interestingly, both Rupert Murdoch and actually Paul Dacre on The Sun are sympathetic to Gordon Brown as an individual, as a human being, but the papers are going to be as brutal as they can be, I suspect, in their treatment of Labour and of him as a Prime Minister. So I think what the party has to do is to try to isolate them from the rest of the media and to try to do everything they can to ensure that the kind of journalism that we're likely to see from that Tory-supporting section of the tabloid press doesn't infect the rest of the media more than it has done in the past. And as you suggested yourself, it is pretty incredible the way in which the BBC has followed The Sun. It followed The Sun very closely during the announcement during the Labour Party conference about The Sun changing its allegiance, turning that into a far bigger story than it deserved to be. It has also brought to public attention the latest stories from The Sun over Mrs. Janes and the death of her son in a way that frankly isn't justified on journalistic merits.
Lance Price there. Let's pick up on some of those points. Maggie, with you first. I mean, The Sun, in effect, has turned itself into an anti-Labour campaign sheet with James Murdoch leading the ideological charge, hasn't it?
Well, I think that the point is, in a way, that they've fired their big gun quite early in the election campaign. And so, yes, everybody is now lining up against them. I would just say en passant, though, this morning, the Mirror fired a pretty big broadside against David Cameron, accusing him of a photo opportunity on Armistice Day by kneeling with all of the poppies and the crosses and positioning the photographer in just the right angle to
it's
get the shot.
It's going to get dirty, isn't it?
So it is. We're in for a Punch and Judy kind of, well, months of it, really, to be absolutely honest with you. On the other side, though, what I've actually enjoyed about this week, leaving aside the recording, is that we've kind of come to a funny consensus about how you conduct public affairs in this country. We do expect our Prime Minister to be incredibly polite and proper in his dealings with members of the public when he contacts them. We would have liked to have seen a copper-plated type of handwriting, wouldn't we, really? Mm. We're, in a way, everybody is pleased that the Prime Minister still writes individually to parents who've lost, say, a child in a war, in battle. And it's kind of reinforced a kind of view about Britain, which I find, actually, myself, when I stand back, quite, I know this sounds odd, quite pleasing, that through the media, we've mediated our way through to a point where we do expect prime ministers to behave in certain ways, and the letter isn't right. We do expect mothers to be upset. And in a funny way, we don't expect The Sun to behave in quite such a nasty way.
Which brings me to the second day, Steve, and the publication of the taped phone call. And that Maggie seems to be suggesting that that's what turned it.
I think what was really interesting, and Lance obviously touched upon it, was I think this is a classic case of brilliant work from Peter Mandelson, because even before the tape came out, he'd started towing that line of being against The Sun and questioning their motives for why they had gone with this story. And obviously the tape was then the final dagger
for them. Yeah, it's quite a delicate line that he had to tread, because he had to be careful that he could attack The Sun without attacking Mrs. Janes at the same time. And that's really, you know, really quite a difficult balancing act for someone to take. And it shows, I think. I think this is what you're suggesting, that Mandelson's an absolute pro at that.
I thought he did it brilliantly. And I thought what was very clever was he quite rightly identified that there would be sympathy, exactly what you've just been saying, Maggie, with the fact that actually at the end of the day, the Prime Minister has taken the time, quite rightly, to write a personal letter which had personal sentiments in it. It clearly wasn't a sort of bog standard letter that gets chucked out to everybody. It had particular references and was a personal letter. Mm. I think Mandelson quite rightly identified the fact that actually there'd be a bit of sympathy there.
And then he phoned her up as well. You know, he's not actually somebody who's just so cold that he doesn't actually care about things. It's amazing, actually, that we've all ended up now, it's Thursday or whenever it is in the week, and we're actually quite sorry for Gordon Brown in all of this, which takes you, you know, you said,
it takes something, doesn't it?
The Daily Mail is one of the great opponents. But in fact, the Daily Mail came out in favour of Gordon Brown yesterday. Yeah. The Times said, you know, that he wasn't actually wrong in what he was trying to achieve. You just have to then go back to the actual quality of the letter itself.
What do you think about the suggestion by Lance Price? Well, actually, I suggest it as well, that the BBC rather slavishly followed the news agenda set by The Sun.
Well, it was a big story. And remember, it's the week of Armistice. Everybody is extremely, extremely concerned about
heightened,
these.
Yeah.
Well, and also, you know, the latest atrocity, the most British soldiers killed in one go. I mean, the legitimacy of the war and why we're there under a United Nations bandwagon, all of that is very, very hot and really relevant to people. And you only had to watch the coverage of the armistice to understand how raw it was, how many people turned up on Sunday at the Cenotaph. This isn't just another story. This is actually has a real resonance now. So, no, I don't. It's very easy to attack the BBC for its news judgments. And we've discussed this in a way before. The BBC, because of 24-hour news, because of everything, everything has more saliency somehow. It's easy to keep pointing back at them because they're on air and they're online all the time and they're around the world. But no, it was a very big story. Everybody else followed it up. And it's provoked a really, really interesting debate. And we're not stopping, are we? Because look, we're already now deep into the politics of the Murdoch family. There are so many, you know, ramifications. Is the BBC being, as it were, cautioned by Mandelson? Well, probably yes, a little bit. You know, everybody's, as you say, having to sort of sit back and take stock.
And there's the angle of the have the Murdochs done a deal with David Cameron, and is Rupert Murdoch calling the shots, or is it James Murdoch running the show? I mean, there are all sorts of angles to this story.
Look at the Parliament Prime Minister's questions yesterday, you know, and Cameron resolutely avoiding or trying to avoid the issue. Clearly, also another interesting fact is really that Sky News has to be impartial. It has different standards to the BBC. It can make mistakes and correct them on air, but fundamentally it is positioned
it's pushed the impartiality thing though quite far with its campaigning for a leaders' debate though, hasn't it?
It's only today that today's Standard there's comments about how after the election we can expect to see laws passed which will usher in or get rid of the impartiality in broadcast news.
I don't think that will happen.
No, I don't think it will. But
it could be eased.
But I don't think it will either. But it's interesting that that's starting to sort of surface. But the one other thing I wanted to say, Matt, and I know it's obvious to say, but I actually find this whole story really distasteful. And at the heart of it, there's a young man who died fighting for his country. And that seems to have been completely glossed over.
Well, I think it's been glossed over because people don't want to go into that bit of it, because that would be the tasteless bit if you started bringing him into it, isn't there? I don't know. But you're right. It certainly has been whitewashed a bit, hasn't it? All right, listen, there's more on this story, obviously, at guardian.co.uk. Let us know what you think. Post a comment on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Of course, none of this would ever have happened if he'd only just scrunched up the paper and started again. That's what I was always encouraged to do at school. I'm Matt Wells, this is Media Talk. Let's move on to some of the other media stories making the news this week. Melvyn Bragg's back on the telly. Are we excited about that?
Well, you know, in a funny way, yes, because, well, yes and no. I'm pleased he's got a television outlet.
talk about damning with fake
praise. No, and also,
but I shall be watching.
Don't you? No, but I will actually be watching his programmes on the King James Bible, because I think it's a really good topic for him. Actually, the more I think about it, don't you actually think that Radio 4 and BBC 2 are in some ways very similar networks in their voices or their... maybe now with Melvyn on BBC Two, and in their kind of interests, really. It just struck me how it was actually a very neat sort of pairing.
I think BBC Two would like to be a similar voice to Radio 4. I think it falls far short of having the sort of breadth and richness of Radio 4.
Well, you think that Janice Hadlow is starting to put that right, don't you, Maggie? Because you wrote that on Media Guardian this week.
I do. I'm extremely... I don't write this as any friend or anything of her, but I have been watching more and more BBC Two recently. And when I look at some of the things that are being announced for the winter schedule... from Science to Lamming Live. I feel, and some of the dramas, I mean, I know, for example, that they've taken Laconia, this story about the German U-boat, which rescued 1,400 people, mainly Italian prisoners of war in World War II, that they're now funding that drama. I can see the makings of a potentially more combative and interesting channel.
Shall we switch to radio? I noticed that, Steve, that there was a collection of local radio bosses meeting one of the DCMS ministers at the radio centre this week, Steve, and they're all a bit concerned about the digital future, and there's a bit of a split at the radio centre anyway. What's going on?
Well, I think they should be concerned about the digital future, shouldn't they? I mean, there is a split, and you've covered this in previous weeks. And fundamentally, it's obviously not a good thing for radio if there's different voices. And I think the one thing Tim Davies fought really hard to try and do is bring a common voice between commercial and BBC in terms of digital interests.
But there's
for now, that split to be happening within the commercial sector, it's like an ongoing nightmare, isn't it? Yes. You can just never get everyone to sing sing from the same sheet.
And what are the differences of opinions? It's over. The bigger groups are want to plough on with digital, and the smaller groups are running out of money, aren't they? Basically,
fundamentally, there's really two factors at play here. There's a money issue at play, and there's a power issue at play. You know, obviously, UTV's reasons for breaking off themselves from the Radio Centre was due to their unhappiness at Global having two seats on the board, and that's only going to carry on, I think, because Global's viewpoint is very much.
We want to be in charge.
We want to be in charge, and you know, that's understandable.
hence the name.
Yeah, we want to achieve the things that are right for our agenda. Yeah.
And of course, digital radio doesn't necessarily suit local radio, does it? I mean, the whole digital.
Right.
I mean, that's the real point, and it's more expensive. And the 2015 switchover. Supposed date is never going to be met.
Well,
it's all hopeless. So
commercially, it just doesn't stack up
doesn't
at the
stack
moment.
Up at all,
so
no.
something's going to have to give, because people aren't going to be able to carry on broadcasting on two systems. It's crippling, isn't it?
And a lot of it is internet radio now. Yeah. I mean, if I was in Peter Jones on Sunday, and I mean, you know, the radios of the future are all basically plugging the fact you can get any kind of radio from the internet. So in a sense, it's
internet radio is not the answer either, is it? I mean, or not at the moment.
Well, you see,
anyway.
FM
it wouldn't be
is
able
still,
to support the bandwidth.
FM, I know, but FM is still a very robust.
FM is the future.
Well, that's what Scott Taunton says.
This is what Scott Taunton
because
says.
There is no killer application for digital radio. That's the real problem.
And now, you know, they're bringing out iPhones with FM radios attached. So, you know, do you know what?
I rest my case.
Shall we set up an FM station? Back to the future, isn't it? I was going to just stick with radio for a second. The Sony Awards are getting yet another category. Advertising, best radio advert. Do you make radio adverts, Steve?
We don't make radio adverts, but I am on the
committee
for the.
Responsible for this?
Well, actually, there's a
long enough night as it is.
There's a serious message behind this. That there's a couple of new categories. One to try and recognise radio advertising, and one to recognise branded content. And actually, the sort of serious message behind all this is that, understandably, there's been some disquiet from the commercial sector. As to whether the awards are relevant at the moment, when you think of some of the categories that truly are BBC-only categories, and you can say, well, commercial radio could make dramas, but, you know, let's be realistic. They're not going to, and it's not going to be a commercially viable thing for them to do. And radio has changed a lot in the last 30 years, and yet, potentially, you could argue some of the categories haven't kept pace with that. And so I think this year, the intention or the aim is to try and refocus slightly to ensure that commercial radio does feel the awards are still relevant and important.
But
for
why
them.
Don't they then drop a couple?
I was just going to say, what categories are you dropping?
Well, actually, there have been some categories dropped as well. So actually, I hope my facts aren't wrong here, but the number of categories. Certainly, I don't think has increased, if it has, it's maybe by one. But there have been a number of categories that have been dropped from last year.
I've never been invited back after I wrote, I think, 3 or 4 years ago that it was ridiculous.
Yes,
they were still giving awards at 11:30 at night.
No, but they did revamp the ceremony. It was a lot better.
I've not been invited back.
No. But your legacy lives on, Maggie Brown. I think it can be said. Before we move, we should end this news and brief section with a moment of silence, I suppose, because. It's the more job cuts at the Guardian, Maggie, this week. Guardian News and Media announced 100 job cuts, 50 from editorial, 50 from, well, around 50 from editorial, and then around 50 from commercial. There's been an announcement of a revamped Observer, which will come in January. They're stopping the Observer magazines, but the Observer, you know, will survive. I suppose it's a sign of what's happening to all media, and we shouldn't be surprised at this.
Well, on the Observer front, I mean, the good news is that the title remains and it does have a core staff. These magazines really began over the past 6 years and were always predicated on finding advertising but also they were seen as the core elements of the Observer brand: sport, music, women, and
they were extensions of where the Observer was already strong.
So, I feel very sorry for the really talented people who've lost their jobs.
Because they're great magazines.
They are very good magazines. And I often, in my sort of, while I was thinking about this, knowing that they were so vulnerable, I just wonder whether anybody would pay for them separately. Certainly, the food one has survived because it does have very strong commercial support. I mean, Nigel Slater is kind of part of that huge food branding side of the Observer. On the other hand, all of these supplements, you know, they've really expanded over the past 20 years when the Sunday Times led the way. And you do have to wonder whether, A, they're what the average reader really wants. I mean, whether they're just so daunted now by the amount of supplements that come through the, or can come through your letterbox or be picked up on a Saturday and Sunday. And secondly, it is an opportunity for newspapers who are going to have to employ smaller staffs, maybe to go back to their knitting, which is actually news, current affairs, and really good analysis, and maybe stop some of the more showbizzy elements.
Don't say that on a podcast. Right. There are links to all of these stories at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Columnist, miserablest, TV presenterist, The Guardian's Charlie Brooker is someone who, it seems, can do no wrong. He was crowned Columnist of the Year at this year's British Press Awards. His Screen Wipe programme on BBC Four won a Royal Television Society Award, and his zombie miniseries Dead Set got nominated for a BAFTA. He'll be back with a second series of Newswipe in the new year, and a new vehicle called So Wrong It's Right starts on Radio 4 soon. That's quite exciting. And he's got a book of his Guardian column out, which was why Charlie was interviewed this week by fellow Guardian columnist Marina Hyde at an audience with type event here at The Guardian. Marina asked him how he found making the leap from people's newspapers to their TV screens, in particular presenting the Channel 4 panel show You Have Been Watching.
It was weird because there's an audience, and I'm now more used to sitting and talking in front of an audience, but I certainly wasn't then. And also I had an earpiece in. Where there's constantly people. That's the weirdest thing, I think, is the earpiece, because there's somebody talking you through it, a bit like air traffic control or something, and going, OK, we're going to bring in the... We've got the clip ready, but, you know, for such and such a thing. But they would always say things at the precise moment that somebody was saying something you were supposed to listen to. And so what you'd end up doing was going, ah, yes! And then introducing a clip. It was a bit... It was weird, and I think we're doing it again. I think I'm doing it again. So I'm doing my Penance and then my mainstream thing again, where I'm doing my Newswipe and then another You Have Been Watching, I think, next year. But it was interesting. I learned lots of things that I think stand-ups spend years learning, and I had to sort of learn on the trot. Things like there's a wave of fear that hits you at different times. So obviously the first week, it was before I went on, I was basically... When I get nervous, I have to piss a lot. And I think it made people think I had a coke problem or something like that, because I'd sort of go, I've got to go to the... Like, literally every few... And then I'd come out a bit manic, because I was so scared. But I really wasn't doing anything that glamorous. I was literally urinating, like a cow. And yes, so wave of fear beforehand. And then the next week I was really calm, and then a sudden wave of terror hit me about 10 minutes in. And then like about week three, the most frightening thing happened, which was a wave of existential horror washed over me while I was... I'm sitting there doing the show, and suddenly a large chunk of my head just floated out of my brain and hovered over the room going, this is weird, isn't it? You're hosting a television programme. Look, there's a set behind you and guests and people staring at you, and you've got an auto cue. What would happen if you just went mad now? What would happen if you just fell on the floor and refused to get up? You could do that. You could refuse to get up. And I'd been warned by somebody beforehand. They said, you'll start making mental requests. You'll start doing... That's what, like, the talent do. The talent go mad and start... And I thought, that's not going to happen to me. And sure enough, by about week five... I can't remember exactly what it was. I made some fucking loopy request. I can't remember. It was like I demanded, like, a Fiorentine... Is it a Fiorentine pizza or something like that? From Pizza Express delivered to my dressing room. And then I caught myself doing... What? I don't know why it seemed so important at the time. It's just... I think it does... it's a psychotic experience, and I don't recommend it for anyone.
The one and only Charlie Brooker there. He is fantastic, isn't he, Steve?
Very.
And I did like that. He described his Channel 4 show as a penance. You have been watching. He obviously felt guilty that he did a sort of mainstream type panel show, but it was really good.
I mean, he's just a big personality, isn't he? I mean, that's the great truth. I mean, television, radio, newspapers. I mean, we all love a big personality. He's kind of not Jeremy Clarkson, but he's a real blokey, blokey bloke.
Well, there is a link between Charlie Brooker and Jeremy Clarkson, which I was going to come on to in a minute. But I just have to give the plug, because that clip was part of a video of his Q&A, a full video. There's an hour, if you're really, really into Charlie Brooker, there's an hour's worth practically of it at guardian.co.uk/TV. And you can head to the blog for a link to the Guardian bookstore as well, which is where you can get hold of Charlie's new book at a reduced rate. But this connection I was going to say between Charlie Brooker and Jeremy Clarkson is that they both top the list of top 10 newspaper columnists that researchers found this week that online readers would be prepared to pay for. Clarkson of the Times and the Sunday Times, I should say, and the Sun is number one. Brooker is second, and then we go through Richard Littlejohn, Giles Corran, Simon Heffer, number five, Gordon Smart from The Sun, weirdly. Well, he does the bizarre column, so that's why people said that. Lorraine Kelly from The Sun. Peter Hitchens from The Mail on Sunday. Then back to The Sun for Jane Moore at number nine. And coming in at number 10, Melanie Phillips, Mad Mail, number 10.
So no Jan Moore?
Funnily enough, no. I did ask the people formerly known as the audience on Twitter what they would pay for.
It's because people want to laugh.
Yes, Maggie,
and
yes.
Don't you think it's because people want to laugh? And so therefore,
why are half the names on this list then if they want to laugh?
No. Why they're at the top? Why Jeremy Clarkson
and Brooker? Yes,
because they just make you laugh out loud, yes, don't they?
Yes,
and that's why you buy them as a download.
Simon Heffer, I'm not sure he's a barrel of laughs.
I meant the top two.
Scott Matthewman agreed, Charlie Brooker, and Caitlin Moran, so that sort of supports your argument. Eamon, only Emily Bell, he said. Nicola Osborne said Brooker, maybe Hadley Freeman. And James Seddon said, let's lock Jan Moore behind a paywall and use the money to pay for poorly animals. Matt Baker said he would pay Maggie Brown to never write about Channel 4 again.
That's a deal.
How much? Matt Baker is the head of press at Channel 4.
Did Luke Johnson get any mentions, by the way? Because he's got a column in the
Luke Johnson wasn't mentioned as a columnist you'd be prepared to pay for, sadly. Can you imagine paying? I mean, this is the idea that you might pay 10 pence or 20 pence or small amounts of money to read columnists. And this is the future for journalism. It's a bit depressing, isn't it, Steve?
It's very depressing, and I'm the worst person to ask about this, because I have to say I have a pet hate about columnists.
Oh, yeah.
I really do. I'm just not interested what Jane Moore thinks about the latest issues of the day. I'm really not. And I do think with someone like Charlie Brooker there's a difference, because he's a sort of wordsmith as well. He's very clever with his words. And I used to feel the same with Russell Brand.
It's not really to do with his opinions.
No, that's right.
It's how he constructs the column entertaining.
That's right. I used to feel the same with Russell Brand when he was writing his football column on the back of The Guardian. Again, it wasn't about football. It was just a very funny column to read. But I think you're right, Maggie. You can clearly see already on the internet what people are prepared to pay for is fantastic content. And very often that is comedy content. Yeah. It's stuff that makes them smile, not stuff that makes them angry. And actually, quite a number of these names are potentially people who can get a reaction out of you, but that's not a positive reaction. And I would really question any survey that says people are prepared to pay to hear Jane Moore's views or Melanie Phillips' views. I just don't buy into that at all.
Yeah, we'll see, I'm sure, in the next year when all of these newspapers start charging. Thank you very much for that. That's almost it. But before we go, though, we have to ask you, Maggie and Steve, you need to tell us what you've learned this week. Shall I tell you what I've learned? I've learned that there's probably going to be a rather more festive atmosphere than usual, or perhaps not, at the Channel 4 News Christmas party this year, because they're combining the annual sort of office Christmas outing with the more for redundancy party. So you know they're saying they're axing Channel 4
yes.
News and More 4 News. Well, they're having
More 4 News.
Yes, doing lunchtime news. Well, they're having the same party together. So that should be interesting under the mistletoe. What have you learned?
Well, I was at the Advertising Effectiveness Awards, and I find myself talking to somebody who's talking to ITV about a new promotion in which they promote themselves as the brighter side. And this struck me
yes,
as
ITV,
very
that
odd.
Is, the they are the brighter
but
side.
They're planning yes. a brand new kind of, and I kept thinking, well, ITV, the cowl side maybe or something, but it just seemed very odd to me so much effort is going. But apparently the normal viewer doesn't know what it means. They think, oh, is this a programme that you're talking about?
Right.
Which I found very interesting.
Yeah.
Because we're not used to ITV, really, are we, talking about itself very much.
In existential terms.
In existential terms, no.
Absolutely. Steve, what have you found out in your travels?
I've learned this week that maybe the media sometimes can be positive, especially in the Media Guardian podcast often brings a very cynical view on things. And purely because I don't know whether it's just me and the things I've been doing this week, but I feel this year, Remembrance Sunday and Armistice Day seem to have had a much greater focus than in previous years.
People wearing poppies?
Yeah, I was touched in a very personal way on two occasions. First, on Sunday, when my sons, who are 10 and 8, they were playing their football games, and all the teams on about 20 pitches held a minute's silence before the games, which was a terrific thing for kids to take part in. And then, funnily enough, at the Sony Awards committee meeting this week, Tim Blackmore, who's the chairman, spoke very eloquently, and at 11 o'clock, we stopped for the 2 minute silence. And I think part of this has been actually because the media have given a great focus to it, maybe in a different way from previous years. And I actually think it's a wonderful thing, and I hope it continues to grow year on year.
Well, on that warm note, thank you very much to Steve Ackerman and Maggie Brand. Links to all our stories, as usual, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. We're on Facebook and Twitter too. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Welsh. Thanks for listening.